The topic for this morning, Etz Hashem Lineder, is the Torah's position on homosexuality. What we'll be discussing is homosexual practice, not orientation. Everything that the sources we're going to be discussing are all addressing homosexual behavior, homosexual practice. I'm not aware of anything which in and of itself, in terms of my own limited knowledge, that statement isn't worth anything, but also in terms of everything that's quoted on the subject, the Torah doesn't talk about a person who feels that he or she has an homosexual orientation. So what we're discussing about is the practice of homosexuality. We begin with the pasuk in Parshas Achrimos. The pasuk says, "Vez zochel osishkav mishke ve'isha to'evahi." Literally, the pasuk translates as we have it, so hopefully provided here, that again addressing a man that he should not lie with another man, as one does with a woman. So the Torah's euphemism of tamai is a euphemism for having relations. More refined, but otherwise similar to, just like in the English idiom, you'll excuse the crudeness, that in English that there's a crude idiom of so-and-so is sleeping with so-and-so, and clearly that's intended again as somewhat of, as a euphemism for relations. So that's the same lahavdil. That's the same usage of what lo sishkav means in the Chumash. So this is an unequivocal statement, a prohibition of male homosexuality. The pasuk doesn't address female homosexuality. This pasuk only addresses male homosexuality. Now, the parsha of Arayos, of forbidden adulterates or incestuous or homosexual relationships, so the parsha of Arayos appears twice in the Chumash. It appears once in Sefer Vayikra and Parshas Achrimos, where the Torah details the prohibitions, and then it appears a second time in the following parsha, in Parshas Kedoshim, where the Torah then details what punishment, Rachman Litzlan, is forthcoming for a person who violates those aforementioned prohibitions. So in the second source, which is drawn from Parshas Kedoshim, so the Torah again now is detailing what the person who again engages in homosexual practice is liable for. The isha sheyishkav as zocha mishke ve'isha to'eva osu shneim. A man, again, who lies with another man and has, again, as with a woman, meaning that there are relations, to'eva osu shnehem, they're both guilty of having committed an abomination, mos yumosu d'mehem bam, and they would be liable for capital punishment, for the death penalty administered by a qualified religious court. Obviously, that isn't something that we have in our day for many reasons. You have to have a Sanhedrin in the Beis HaMikdash in order to have capital punishment. You have to have that unbroken chain of smicha, of ordination, going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. The smicha, the ordination we have today is not that smicha. So for many reasons, for us, it's more of a theoretical statement, but one which clearly serves as a barometer, as a way of measuring the severity of the prohibition. But the Rambam writes in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, he says that if a person wants to get a sense for what the severity of prohibitions in the Torah is, that not all prohibitions are of the same severity, so one can look to see what the generally, not always, sometimes this doesn't work, but generally one can look to see what the punishment is that's associated with that prohibition. And the more severe the punishment, so clearly the more serious the violation and the prohibition. Again, both of these verses deal with male homosexuality. Earlier in Parshas Achimos, going back to Parshas Achimos here for a moment, so the right before the section in the Torah, again, which deals with forbidden relations, begins, so we have in source 3, we read the following pasuk. Kemaseh Eretz Mitzrayim asher yeshavtem bo lo asasu. You shouldn't act as the inhabitants of Mitzrayim, of Egypt, do, nor should you act, should you follow the practice of the current inhabitants of Eretz Canaan, right, the land of Israel, where I'm bringing you. And don't follow, again, their accepted traditions or practices. On this pasuk, so what are those chukosehem lo solechu? What are those behaviors which are practiced in Eretz Canaan? Rashi quotes from Chazal, before we see source number 4, that of the whole world, the two places which were most morally corrupt were Eretz Mitzrayim and Eretz Canaan. The inhabitants of those two places were the most corrupt. They engaged in the most morally offensive forms of behavior. So the Taras Kohanim is the Tanaitic teachings on the book of Vayikra. So the Taras Kohanim on this pasuk comments, if you take a look at line 3 in the Hebrew of the source, Umahoyu Osim, what were these quote unquote traditional behaviors in the land of Canaan? Ha'ish no se le'ish, ha'isha no le'isha. That what the Torah is prohibiting in saying b'chukosam lo selechu, here this prohibition of homosexual behavior includes not only male homosexuality but female homosexuality as well. This pasuk with the Taras Kohanim then serves as the source, and number 5, we're not going to read it together, serves as the source for how it's codified in the Shulchan Aruch. So again, as we said last time, in a world that wasn't confused and that hadn't lost its moral compass, so basically, the shir should be over. There is no discussion. If you look in over 1,000 years of responsa, you won't find a single responsum about is homosexual behavior permissible, because there's no need to write responsa about psukim and chumash. When you have a question which is a new situation, which is an intricate question, so then the halachic decisors write responsa to clarify based on the sources what the din is. But Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about someone who had, Rachman al-Islam, engaged in such behavior, turned to Rav Moshe for guidance about how to do tshuva. So that you can find in the literature. But there is no literature because there is nothing to talk about. It's just unequivocal, categorical psukim in the Chumash. People have, and the entire shir is with a very heavy heart. People have invented excuses for ignoring unequivocal psukim and unequivocal tradition. So one of the excuses which is out there is that, yes, there is such a pasuk in Sefer Vayikra, but that pasuk is addressed to a man who's heterosexual. But it's not addressed to a man who's homosexual. Obviously no scriptural or textual or traditional basis for that, but that's sort of the excuse for ignoring or trying to deflect an explicit pasuk. So to get perspective on that, so we need to orient ourselves a little bit into Torah Shebichsav, Torah Shebaalpeh, the relationship between the two. If you take a look in source number 10, so source number 10 is drawn from the Rambam's introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah. It's something that, I mean, everything, obviously, by definition, everything that the Rambam wrote is well worth studying, but there are really very, very fundamental concepts and ideas which, to understand our tradition, to understand Torah, that the Rambam presents, again, with such lucidity here in the introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah. Let's read a little bit. Da, ki kol mitzvah shenasan HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe Rabbeinu, you should know that these are the opening lines. I mean, the Rambam is beginning with I guess what is perhaps the most, one of the most basic ideas, and in terms of Torah, da ki kol mitzvah shenasan HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe Rabbeinu olav shalom, you should know that every mitzvah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave on Har Sinai, on the Mount, on Mount Sinai, to Moshe Rabbeinu, nasna lo b'perusha. He gave Moshe Rabbeinu the mitzvah with its accompanying explanation, its accompanying, call it the user's manual, a guide to how the mitzvah is to be performed. Ha'yo'omer lo ha'mitzvah. First, HaKadosh Baruch Hu would communicate the mitzvah itself, the commandment, to Moshe Rabbeinu, the achakach, and then immediately thereafter, omelo perusha v'inyana. Then he would explain the practicalities and the technicalities of how the mitzvah is to be implemented, how the mitzvah is to be observed, what you need to do to comply with the mitzvah. Now the Rambam, sort of that's a more abstract description, so now the Rambam concretizes it with an illustration. So if you take a look at the bottom paragraph now here in source 10, Herbosai. So vihine l'cho moshal, and here's, I'll give you for instance, I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about, says the Rambam. Sha'akadosh Baruch Hu amar l'moshe, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe Rabbeinu, basukos teshvu shivas yomim. So the mitzvah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, it's a mitzvah to dwell in sukkahs for 7 days. Now that pasuk alone, like, what do you do with that pasuk? Who's supposed to dwell in a sukkah? What's a sukkah? What constitutes a sukkah? How do you construct a sukkah? You can't really do anything with the Torah Shebichsav. The Torah Shebichsav always is incomplete without the accompanying Torah Shebaalpeh. The written law is, at best, intentionally too vague without the accompanying explanation and interpretation of the oral law. So Achar Kein, so first HaKadosh Baruch Hu presents the Moshe Rabbeinu this pasuk, Basukos Teshu Shivas Yomim, and then subsequently, Achar Kein Hodia, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu taught Moshe Rabbeinu, Shehasukah Hazos Chova Al HaZuchorim Lo HaNekevus. So the first, note that the first thing the Rambam says, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructed Moshe Rabbeinu, and again, this is an illustration, this is intended to be representative of how HaKadosh Baruch Hu taught Moshe Rabbeinu each and every mitzvah. So what's the most basic thing you have to know? The most basic thing you have to know, which then became ensconced and transmitted through our tradition, is to whom is this mitzvah addressed? To whom does this mitzvah apply? So this mitzvah in the case of sukkah is chova al hazuchorim la makevus. The mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah is obligatory for men, not so for women. Another class of exemption from the mitzvah, v'she'en hacholim chayavim ba v'lo holchei derech. People who are ill are exempt from the mitzvah. Doesn't have to be a life-threatening illness. People who are ill are exempt from the mitzvah. Similarly, people who are in the midst of a journey. V'shelo yihya sichucha el b'tzemach ha'aretz. That the sach, that the overhead covering in the sukkah, has to be something that grows from the ground. The Rambam goes on to say, and it can't be other materials which don't grow from the ground. It can't be something which is susceptible to Kabbalah, for Kabbalah's tumah, for being rendered impure, etc. So that means that the tradition that we have about mitzvahs, each mitzvah HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Moshe with the basic information, the basic details which are indispensable to have observed that mitzvah, to comply with that mitzvah. The very first example that Rambam gives is, to whom is the mitzvah of sukkah addressed? It's clear for thousands of years, no one ever suggested, it never ever occurred to anyone, that the pasuk in Vayikra of Ezrochel Osishka Mishke Ve'isha that categorically prohibits homosexual behavior, homosexual relations, that pasuk distinguishes between a man who's heterosexual or homosexual, was never ever said. The reason it was never ever said was because it's a tradition for thousands of years, which we know where those traditions go back to. Those traditions go back to Har Sinai. The following is said, again, as is everything, with a heavy heart. It's not a word which is really part of my active vocabulary, because it's a very heavy word. So it's not part of my active vocabulary. But to say that is heresy. To say that the pasuk in Ve'es Zocha Lo Sishka Mishka Ve'isha is addressed only to a heterosexual man, not to a homosexual man. So we know from the Rambam that the basic details, the basic facts of every mitzvah are a part of the accompanying oral law which was given to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai. When one comes in the year 2000, and I don't know when this was invented, whether it was 19 or 18 or 17, I don't know when this distortion was invented, and one says differently, so one is denying the oral law which was given to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai. Go back now to source 9, please, Rabbi Osei. Source 9 is also drawn from the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah. It's where the Rambam famously lists the 13 principles of faith which define what Jewish faith is and what demarcates faith from heresy. Hayisod Hashmini, Hayos HaTorah Min HaShamayim, that the Torah, and we'll see in a minute, the translation of this phrase of Torah Min HaShamayim is not only that a Torah was given Min HaShamayim, but the translation of this phrase, you'll see in a minute why this translation is warranted. The translation of this phrase, the correct translation of this phrase, is that the Torah we have is Min HaShamayim. The Torah we have was given from heaven, from above, from God to Moshe. V'hu shenamin, that we should believe. Ki kol haTorah hazos hanesuna ayidei Moshe Rabbeinu alav hashalom shehi kula mipi ha'gvur. This Torah that we have, the Torah that we take out of the Aron Kodesh and that we read from Monday, Thursday, Shabbos, this Torah is the Torah which that Moshe Rabbeinu brought down to us. It's entirely from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Every pasuk, every word, every syllable. Now, if you turn the page, and you take a look five lines from the end of this excerpt, Rabbi Yossi. Ukemochein, and similarly, Perish HaTorah HaMekubal, the traditional understanding of the written Torah, i.e., the oral Torah. Ukemochein, Perish HaTorah HaMekubal, similarly, the explanation, the interpretation, the traditional explanation, interpretation of the Torah, Gan Kein Mipi HaGvura. That's also from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And look, v'zeh she'anu osim hayom, that which we do today, mitavnes ha'sukkah, the way our sukkahs look, the lulav, the species that we take, that we identify as a lulav, what we employ as a shofar, the way our tzitzis look, the way our tefillin, hu ba'atzma hatavnes, this is the same form, shape, species, etc., she'amar Hashem Yisborach l'Moshe, which God communicated to Moshe Rabbeinu. When one challenges, God forbid, the traditional interpretation of these basic identifications and definitions of mitzvah, it contradicts this principle of faith, and that's what it is. Another excuse that has been put forth to somehow or other reconcile the irreconcilable of someone wanting to profess to be a practicing Orthodox Jew and a practicing homosexual. So another excuse that's been put forward is that there is a principle in halacha of onus. And there is a phrase that appears in the Talmud of onus rachmana patre. So the principle of onus is that a transgression which occurs due to coercion, a person is not held responsible for. The context in which the Torah presents it, the Torah says that if a married woman, God forbid, is raped, so then the Torah says, v'lanar l'sasav dova, that Bezdin should not punish her. Of course she shouldn't be punished, because what happened was due to coercion. So that's another excuse that's been put forth to reconcile the irreconcilable. No one really thinks that's true, because if you buy into that, then you have to give the same pass to rapists and people who engage in pedophilia and every other and anything that makes any civilized person outraged. Because if there's no expectation that a person can overcome and control urges, so then any behavior, the most vile behavior in the world, can be whitewashed based on that. There's nothing unique about the... I apologize for the bluntness of the language. There's nothing unique about the drive in this area. If that's considered coercion, then every urge, the urge that a rapist has, will also be considered coercion, and we should give them a pass. No civilized person believes that. No civilized person has ever believed that. No civilized person ever will believe that. We believe that a person has free will, that a person can control. We have instincts, we have urges, we have desires, and then we also have a seichel, an intellect, that is capable of identifying whether or not those drives, urges, and desires are healthy or unhealthy, permissible or prohibited, and then we have the free choice to control our behavior. If you take a look, there's a classic formulation of what the principle of free will is here in source number 11. Again, drawn from the Rambam, but there's nothing in terms of what we're talking about, nothing idiosyncratic. It's not that there's anything particularly Maimonidean about what he's saying. It's Jewish. It's not only Jewish. It's universal. Rishus l'chol adam nesuna, that the Rambam writes, the capacity is given to every man, every person. If he wants to incline himself, herself, to the path of goodness and to be a righteous person, he has the capacity to do so. If the person wants to incline himself, he wants to put him on a track of evil and to be a wicked person, or shizbiyada. He has that capacity as well. Skip to Halacha Gimel there in line 6, Rabbi say. V'davar ze ikar gadol hu. This is a major principle. V'hu amud ha-Torah v'ha-mitzvah. This is the pillar on which the entire Torah and the entire system of mitzvos rests. You remove this pillar, you challenge the axiom that a person is endowed with free will, freedom of action, freedom of behavior, to control and determine his own behavior, so the whole system of Torah and mitzvahs collapses. As the Rambam goes on to say, what is God giving us commandments for if we don't have free will to choose to comply or obey? How is it just for God to reward or punish if we don't have free will to comply or Rahman al-Islam not to comply? Part of the brainwashing of modern society is that people's noble instinct for sympathy and compassion is co-opted into rallying their support, again, not for people who have such an orientation, we're not talking about that. We're talking about for people who engage in such behavior and seek to do so by, in terms of our focus, by distorting Torah. You have to have sympathy. You have to have sympathy. So we're told that having sympathy means legitimizing the behavior. And otherwise, a person is guilty of being cruel and hard-hearted and some kind of phobic person. So let's discuss that for a minute. Sympathy, kindness, all those beautiful cardinal Torah values that the Torah introduced into the world, that the Torah taught the world, can never be applied independent of the moral system of what's right and wrong. But let's try to explain that. Is it an act of kindness if I'm sitting at the table? Long table, 6-foot table. I'm sitting at one end, and someone's sitting at the other end. In front of me, there's a bottle of wine. And he says, can you please pass the bottle? So is it a kind thing for me to pass him the bottle? Yes, no, maybe, or what's that?
Depends
on what?
Whether the guy's an alcoholic or not.
So if he's healthy and he wants to make Kiddush, yeah, it's a kind thing. If he's an alcoholic who's struggling to, or maybe he's not struggling, which is even worse, to control his alcoholism, so then it's not sympathy for me to pass him the bottle of wine. It's misplaced sympathy, which is really just feeding this habit that could kill him. So what's good, what's kind, what's an expression of sympathy can never be divorced, can never be separated from right and wrong. There's no, one can't talk about goodness acontextually. What's good may be good in one context and may be inherently bad and evil in another context. Is it a good thing to go around sticking people with needles? Generally, no. But if you're inoculating them and preventing them from horrible diseases, it's a wonderful thing to do, and a mitzvah to do. So goodness, sympathy, kindness, they're not freestanding concepts that can be applied without being integrated into the moral system of what's right and wrong. To, in quotation marks, sympathetically support homosexual behavior. Again, we're talking about behavior. To, in quotes, sympathetically support homosexual behavior is to encourage someone to violate one of the most severe and serious prohibitions in the Torah. Is to encourage someone to do something which the severity of the prohibition is such that, again, for us it's more of a theory which serves as a barometer, which is liable for capital punishment. So that's sympathy? Well, that's the ultimate cruelty. Expression of cruelty. Given that things are so painfully self-evident, how is there so much confusion? Again, there couldn't. It's sort of like what we're doing today is sort of like asking a math teacher to give a 45-minute presentation on why 2 plus 2 is 4. That's really the analog to this morning's conversation. So given that things are so unequivocal and so crystal clear, how is there so much confusion? A. Take a look at source 16, please, Nebraska. Derech Briyaso Shel Adam. Human nature is such. Leos Nimshach B'Deoso V'Vemasov. That a person is drawn, that an influence is exerted upon a person, b'deosav, in terms of his character traits, u'b'masav, in terms of his behavior, achareyav v'chaveyav, he's influenced by his surroundings, by colleagues, by friends, and it doesn't, the sphere of influence is not limited to colleagues and friends. Nohei keminag anshei medinasa. People are influenced by the social surroundings. Society, if a person is not aware of the potential and doesn't seek to counteract it, society exerts a very strong influence on what we do and how we behave. when a person doesn't filter, it was always necessary, but never, I don't know if it was ever as necessary, the ancient Greeks were pretty corrupt also, so I can't tell you, I don't know which society is more corrupt, whether that of ancient Greece or that of today's society, so I don't know, but it's hard to imagine that it was ever more necessary in the history of the world to filter, okay, before the Marble things weren't so good, so presumably that one was worse. A person can't just live in society without a filter. I live in New York City. New York City, there's a whole halachic debate about whether you have to filter your water. So there are many big rabbanim on both sides of the issue, but so many big rabbanim say you can't drink water without filtering. So in New York City, so many people don't drink the water without filtering. Even if you live outside of New York City, wherever you live in Western society today, there has to be a very, very good filter. Because without that filter, without being conscious of just how susceptible we are to societal influence, so we are influenced. Go back for a moment, please, to source number 3, and you'll see something remarkable. Kamasei Eretz Mitzrayim Asher Yeshavtem Bo Lo Sa'asu. Don't you imitate the behavior of Eretz Mitzrayim where you lived. Uchmasei Eretz Kanaan Asher Ani Mevi Eschem Shoma Lo Sa'asu. Don't you mimic the behavior of the inhabitants of Eretz Kanaan where you're going. Question. Why does the Torah have to identify Eretz Mitzrayim? At this point in the Chumash, we don't know what Eretz Mitzrayim is. At this point in the Chumash, we don't know that we were in Mitzrayim for 210 years. We know very well. We know where Mitzrayim is on the map, and we know very well that our passports are stamped that we lived in Mitzrayim. And we also know where we're headed. So why is the Torah identifying Eretz Mitzrayim and Eretz Kanaan? But it's clear what the Pasuk means. The Pasuk is telling us, maybe you'll think that you don't have to have your guard up against the practices of Eretz Mitzrayim and Eretz Kanaan. They're so off. They're so repugnant. I don't have to be on guard. I don't have to worry about that. Okay, show me, a very tasty looking cheeseburger. Okay, so that has some appeal. So I'm going to have to be on guard against that. But the behaviors of Eretz Mitzrayim and the behaviors of Eretz Kanaan, again, Chazal say they were the two most corrupt societies. I don't need to be on guard against that. I wouldn't do it anyway. You don't even have to tell me what the prohibitions are. Says the Torah, Asher Yeshavtem Bo, the fact that the practices are so repugnant, that they're so off, don't be lured into a false sense of security of thinking that you're not susceptible to doing, because Asher Yeshavtem Bo, you were there, you were exposed to their influence, and you're headed to Eretz Kanaan. And you're going to be exposed to that influence. So no matter how inherently, objectively repugnant their behaviors are, you are going to be susceptible. And you have to be careful about this. You have to know that. And you have to be careful about it, because otherwise, if a person doesn't have his guard up against societal influence, it's human nature. And we're all human, and therefore we all have whatever weaknesses and whatever susceptibilities are part of human nature. One or two last comments. The first one is I apologize, is out of order. I should have said it before. Another very tragic, brazen statement that's made in this context made by someone who's one of the activists, again, activists to legitimize the behavior, which is what we're talking about. Quote, "We don't have a problem. Orthodox Judaism has a problem." Let's take a look at source number 12, Reb Osler. Hayesod HaRishon, the first of the 13 principles of faith which define traditional Jewish belief, Laham in Metzias HaBori Yisbarach, to believe in the existence of God the Creator. Now, let's try to get a... It's impossible to give a real definition of Hashem, of God, but let's sort of give a working definition, to have a little bit of a feel for what we're talking about when we use that holy word. V'hu sheyesham nimtza shalem b'chol darkei hametzius. There's a perfect being in every imaginable fashion. Nimtza shalem, a perfect being b'chol darkei hametzius, in every possible way. Hu ilas hametzius, he's the cause, the source of all existence. Hanimtza im kulam bo kiyum metziusam umimenu kiyumam. Existence is God's, and he shares it with us, but existence is his. The traditional Jewish belief since Avraham Avinu, is that God is perfect. There's nothing problematic in God's Torah. In the world around us, so sometimes people just think of God as a brilliant physicist who's even more brilliant than the Hall of Fame in physics, and that's what they discover in the world. So we certainly don't contest that part of it, but for us, God is a source of morality. He's not just the source of nature. He is the source of nature, and he is the source of natural law. But God is the source of all morality as well. There's no such thing as anything in the Torah which is problematic. And whatever, I don't want to come back to the H word again, but there's no such thing as saying that we don't have a problem. Orthodox Judaism has a problem. What should our attitude based on all this be practically? So our attitude to someone who feels that he or she has a homosexual orientation but is not looking to condone or legitimize the behavior and is in a private, dignified manner looking to deal with that challenge should be one of unmitigated support. No one should ever use condescending words or slurs or anything of that. It has absolutely no place. Rabbonim, family members, should lend whatever moral support, religious guidance, support on every level to such an individual. If a person is not looking to condone it, a person is not going to celebrate it either, and is not going to be marching down Fifth Avenue celebrating it. That goes hand in hand with looking to legitimize and mainstream the behavior. The effort to, again, legitimize the behavior, to uproot one of Hashem's mitzvahs is something which is opposed on our part, unequivocally, the leiv ha-nefesh. It's looking to not only, which is bad enough, bad enough, not only uproot a prohibition in the Torah, but to do so with a heretical, quote-unquote, justification. Whether that heretical justification is a denial of the Torah Shebal Peh, which tells us to whom the Pasuk is addressed, whether that justification, in quotation marks, is even worse by saying that there's something problematic about one of God's mitzvahs, which doesn't contradict the eighth principle of faith, that contradicts the very first principle of faith. So that's something that we don't have any sympathy for that. We have sympathy for the for an individual who's looking like the rest of us to be a God-fearing Jew, who's not looking to uproot a mitzvah in the Torah, who's not looking to legitimize what's illegitimate. Why do some people have struggles that other people don't have? That's not something that anyone knows. You know, how God decides who's given which challenges and which struggles, no one knows, no one ever will know. When Mashiach comes and we look back at history retrospectively, we're not going to understand everything then either. God is infinite. His knowledge is infinite. His wisdom is infinite. By definition, it can never, ever be totally, totally comprehensible and intelligible to us. All the ways of divine providence will never, ever be fully understood and known to us, because you have to be God to get into, I don't mean this literally, obviously, but figuratively, to get into God's mind and fully understand his ways of providence. He gave us the capacity to understand his Torah, to understand his mitzvahs, to fulfill his mitzvahs. He didn't give us the capacity because it's beyond finite beings, to fully understand his ways of providence. Why do some people have this challenge? I don't know. There are many different types of challenges that only some people have and that many people don't have, and it's a mystery of hashgacha. It's a mystery of divine providence. Practically, halacha l'maisa, it's important to know maybe I forgot to list this source. Oh, yeah. Okay, take a look in source 15, please, Rebecca. We know that a man and a woman, again, not married, it's not a father and a daughter, not a mother and a son, not a brother and a sister, are not allowed to be alone in a secluded place, in a secluded area. The Mechaber writes, Yosef Karo writes in his Shulchan Aruch, in the last line of the first paragraph of Source 14, Ubedaros Halalo, in these generations, 16th century is when Yosef Karo is penning these words, Sherabu Hapritzim, Yesh Lehisrachek Melehisyachidim Hazacha. If the situation is such that violation of the Torah's prohibition against homosexual behavior becomes somewhat widespread, so then that issa yichud, that prohibition against being secluded, applies not only for a man and a woman, but it would apply for two men as well. So the Beis Shmuel says, the Beis Shmuel is one of the major commentaries on this part of the Shulchan Aruch, on the Shulchan Aruch Eben Ezra. It's printed in all standard editions of the Shulchan Aruch in the margin around, surrounding the text of the Shulchan Aruch itself. Quoting again one of the earlier classical authorities, HaMechaber Kasav Kach Lefi Medinasa. This ruling of Rav Yosef Karo reflected the reality of the time and place where he lived. Shehayu Putzim Ba'Averozo, that there was significant breach of this prohibition. Aval, I don't know where the Beishmor lived, I don't know. Aval Medinos Elu, wherever and whenever the Beishmor was living, he didn't live in the 20th or 21st century, he lived a few hundred years ago. Aval Medinos Elu, Ein Tzarech Lehisrachek Medina. It's not required. It's not required. It's kimeduma. Very clear that an individual who feels that he has a homosexual orientation, just halacha lemaaseh, is not allowed. The same way, a heterosexual man can't be alone with a woman. So a man who feels that he has a homosexual orientation can't be alone in a secluded place with another man, for the same rationale that prohibits a heterosexual man from being alone in a private place or area with a woman. Okay, so I think that's maybe one last, one last comment. We spoke about the societal influence. One of the tenets of the society around us is what it perceives as the inalienable right to self-gratification. That's what sort of fuels the society around us. Everyone has an inalienable right to self-gratification. If I want something, I should be able to indulge that desire. That mindset is about as antithetical to the mindset of discipline and restraint, which for the Torah defines Kedusha. Rav Soloveitchik was fond of highlighting the fact that the Rambam in his Mishnah Torah, so he subdivides the Mishnah Torah into 14 books. So the fifth of the 14 books of Mishnah Torah is Sefer Kedusha, the book of holiness, of sanctity. And what does the Rambam deal with it? He deals with the halachas of forbidden relations and dietary laws, because it's in those two areas that the foundation of Kiddush is created. The discipline, which is created by compliance with the Torah's directives, both in the area of dietary laws, what foods a person may eat, what foods not, what relations are permissible, what relations are not, that discipline is the bedrock and foundation of Kedusha. Okay. Thank you.
I'll start with one question that's kind of a follow-up from last time, but next to this as well. For the uneducated Orthodox consumer, whether speaking about tzach, that we should wear tefillin, whether the misinterpretations of the psukim to legitimize homosexual behavior, sometimes those are found coming from rabbis who in their office have smicha and ordination on the wall from an acknowledged yeshiva in Israel or America. Last time you differentiated between rabbi and amora hara, is there any way to guide the uneducated consumer, as I say, how to at least tell how to be an educated consumer and try to see where things are coming from?
So, as is true for you know, any good question, you know, she'elas chacham chatzi tshuva. I think the answer is implied in the question. I also used to buy all my suits in Sims, by the way, so I'm also into, I haven't quite gotten over its demise. I'm also into being an educated consumer. But the choice of the phrase is very apt. That we need to be educated consumers so that we can distinguish between rabbis who are qualified to render halachic rulings, to whom we should look for guidance and psak and decision, and rabbis who, sadly, maybe out of misguided sincerity, I'm not judging anyone's motivations, but rabbis who, sadly, are not in the least bit learned, and have also been co-opted by this tidal wave of moral confusion that exists. A person has to be an educated consumer. The way to be an educated consumer is, we don't all have to be great, great Talmid Chachamim. We should all aspire to it to the best of our ability, but a person doesn't have to achieve that to be to be educated enough to be able to discern and differentiate between different rabbonim. The sad reality is that if you have a combination of rabbis who overstep their boundaries, and again, not commenting on motivation, and as a result, say things that are totally, totally out of bounds, the combination of that with an uneducated consumer is not good. That's a volatile combination, and I don't know of any. The answer is that we need to be educated consumers, and once we're educated consumers, so you can tell whether a suit is a good suit or not a good suit. You know that if it's all polyester, it's a reason it's so cheap and it's not going to breathe, and you're gonna melt. Now, for some of us, that may not be so bad if we would melt a little bit more. That's a different story.
The Rav mentioned that you should show unmitigated support for someone that has an orientation like that. What does the Torah expect of someone in that position? Should they be celibate for the rest of their lives? Should they get married? Like, what's the next step after someone, or is that an individual? Or as a community, do we have a solution to that? Is that communal?
I mean, certainly in a homosexual sense, the person has to be celibate. I mean, that much is uniform and unequivocal. Whether the person is capable of getting married, I think, is very much has to be measured in an individual context. Obviously, it would only be appropriate if it would be in a way that was fair to his partner, to the woman that he would marry. He would have to, you know, be capable of, you know, of the full range of marital obligations. So whether that's an option would be something that presumably would have to be decided on an individual basis.
Thanks again for coming. I really enjoyed that. So I have like a couple of questions. Sort of like last time. I'm actually not sure how.
Just to reassure everyone, we're actually leaving tomorrow night, so you don't have to worry. I'm not coming back next time.
You can all
breathe a sigh of relief. Yeah.
So I'm not sure how well I wrote that. You touched on a lot of different points. I think I'm gonna try to summarize them into two sections. They're both very unrelated. So I think, right, so you started out with more of like halakhic focus, so obviously it seems unequivocal, what the halakhic stance on this issue is. But right, obviously there's a lot of like social implications which even are coming out in the form of preliminary questions about this in terms of how to deal with it. And usually the focus is like for the person who's like dealing with this, how they deal with it. But my question is more geared towards like how does a community deal with someone who's struggling with this issue? So right? Like, I would say that the question is, like, for homosexual, like, Jews, right? We want them to come closer to Torah, be able to be, like, even according to, like, your source 16, you're like, we want people to be in a Torah-oriented environment. Because if they're not there, then they'll have all these ideas and ways of reversing the sense of themselves that might not be as well aligned with Torah. So when it comes to helping people who are in this position to integrate into a community, it seems like there's a few problems that they face in a way that certain ways that they might be overcome, right? So one main thing was sympathy that you mentioned in terms of it being important to treat people who are in these circumstances with sympathy. But so I have a couple of friends who are gay and have left the Orthodox communities that they grew up in and are not uninformed consumers, but very well know everything from halachot to like observant Jewish life. And I think that what they generally ran into was this issue with the fact that on one hand, right, you want for anyone who's struggling with any issue, like whatever sort of issue it is and whatever sin it leads them to engage in, there's this idea, right, that you want people to have organic path of growth. Like you want people to be able to work through their issues in a way that is organic and that can help them to actually get to where they need to get to. But it seems like in this issue, there's not really a prescribed organic path of growth. Like the two main options that I've generally heard thrown around for this issue are either stay celibate or get married to a woman, which seem to each contain, depending on the situation, their own halakhic questionability. And so I'm wondering, like, in terms of for a community who wants to make sure that, like, this kind of person feels comfortable staying in a community context, surrounding themselves with a Torah lifestyle, but also being understood and empathized with and actually feeling that empathy in a way that's not like, oh, you have these two options, and if this doesn't seem like your path of growth, then you can't stay here anymore. So I'm wondering, like, if you have some ideas about that. And then I guess my second question is, and I think I wasn't paying entirely attention to the source that you brought for this, so I can't really say exactly if I'm wording the question in a way that addresses that, but there was this idea that a heterosexual man shouldn't be alone with a woman, so that's obviously like a very well-known halacha. Then there was the other statement that you brought that you said a homosexual man should not be alone in a room with a man. I'm wondering how that chiluk was derived, and how does that relate to how the verse that you brought in the very beginning from the Torah, which I realize is probably on a different level because it's not a commentary and everything else, but how does that relate to the dismissal of the idea that that verse is not addressed to heterosexual people, like you said, they try to use that verse in that way, so how is there this like, direct halakha? And also, what does this potentially mean in terms of like social isolation for people who are in this scenario and like, how they're treating the community?
Okay, so thank you for the sensitive questions. The challenge that an individual who feels that he or she has a homosexual orientation faces is not unique. There are sadly, painfully, tragically, there are heterosexual individuals who want to get married and don't succeed in getting married. And all the challenges that are associated with being single on the various levels, so they experience as well, and people open their homes and they invite people to come and to be guests Shabbos and Yom Tov, and the issue of again, I guess it's not entirely unprecedented based on the source we just read in Shulchan Aruch, but let's say in terms of the past 100 or 200 years, it seems the fact that the challenge arises in a context of homosexuality is is new and different, but it's not fundamentally different than how one integrates a heterosexual individual who hasn't gotten married and whose prospects for getting married are not very good. And we all know that there are lots of such people. No one ever thought that it created a crisis for the community. No one ever thought it created a crisis for the Torah. We deal with it, and we know intuitively how to deal with it. You go to shul, and you see that someone who doesn't have their own family, you invite them, and you welcome them. And we were always able to do that, and we always did that, because no one was looking to solve or avoid their challenge by trying, God forbid, to rewrite the Torah. So I think there are, you know, there's a trail that's been blazed for dealing with it. In terms of your second question, also excellent, and it's very important to clarify that as well. The issue yichud is not drawn from the prohibition against being alone in a secluded area. Is not drawn from, let's say, the verse that says that adultery is forbidden. So that verse is just talking about the act of adultery. It's not talking about being in a secluded area with a married woman. Similarly, the verse that prohibits homosexuality prohibits the homosexual act. It's not talking about the prohibition of being in a secluded area. There is an independent prohibition of yichud, d'rabbanan, d'oraisa, whatever. That's a different conversation. There is an independent prohibition of yichud, which then gets applied to most, but not all, of the forbidden relationships. So again, since incest between a husband and a daughter, between a mother and a son, is so against the natural instincts that we have, so the prohibition of yichud doesn't apply there. At most points in history, that same reasoning carried over to the prohibition of engaging in of homosexual behavior as well. It was experienced as something unnatural, and because of that, the same way a father is allowed to be alone with a daughter, even though, if God forbid, that would be an incestuous relationship, and a mother can be alone with a son, even though that would be an incestuous relationship. So two men can be together, even though that also would be a forbidden relationship. When the ground underneath shifts, again, it's not the halacha changing, it's the reality to which halacha is being applied, and that prohibition is something which there's a lot, which is breached a lot, so then certainly someone who feels that he's susceptible to that because of the way he experiences orientation, so he's no longer analogous to the father, daughter, mother, son, he's analogous to the man-woman relationship. Is that,
so would he be allowed to be alone with a woman though?
The answer, which is a little bit too lengthy and will take us too far afield, is I think no, but maybe some other time we can talk about that.
I'm not sure if this is included in this question, but Rebbe distinguished between a situation of someone who is, of course, spade to spade, was engaging in heretical statements, trying to challenge the Torah or challenge the first world of perfection. We call it the rabble rousers, the leaders of whatever abbreviations I use now. Which itself is about political correctness, to try to label it as something. But there are many, broadly speaking, in the Orthodox world, who have given into their Titus, just like there are many, broadly speaking, in the Orthodox world, who were sin in other ways as well. And I think a question, both as Balabhatam and Azravanam that counseling has to be addressed is what kinds of sinful activities lead to a situation where you're no longer welcome in our synagogues, in our schools, in our communities? And what kind of sinful situations, without condoning and without any way justifying, without any way trying to rewrite the Torah, but we have to deal with the person as someone who is, let's say, not one of the rabble-rousers, but someone who's recognizing the fact that he's, very mentioned to the fact that someone who has orientation but never sins in that way clearly is deserving our sympathy. What about the person who is sinning in that way? To what extent, again, if he's not trying to attack the Torah, is he also deserving of our sympathy in terms of not that in any way condoning the behavior, but he's a sinner, he's a chayte, and a chayte, we, to a large extent, are, we have to try to be makariv. So, the muskel rishon, I think, of many communities, because toeva, etc., is that, if that's what he is, we have to kick him out. But that doesn't necessarily seem to be the nuanced approach that we should be taking. And when do we draw the line and saying, you can't be part of a shul, you can't be a, you can't be a Tari, you can't be a chazan, and so on and so forth. And what nuance perhaps would Rebbe present to that? If someone who is sinning, but still wants to be a part of the shul, recognizing the fact that he is a Baal Taiva who's engaging in prohibited activity. I think that might have been part of Bradley's question in terms of the fact that people didn't feel at home in the Orthodox community because they were ostracized, so they just dumped the whole thing. And that's clearly, I don't think, something we want. One of the boys mentioned to me on the field that there was a rav recently who said, and I'm sure it was all taken out of context because of the press was against anyone who has to show him open his mouth against this, that if you're a homosexual, to throw off your kippah. So it was probably in the context of someone who was trying to justify the behavior and saying that it was justified by the Torah, but that kind of attitude and the perception that that's what Orthodoxy preaches, that if you're a sinner, to throw off your kippah, I think it's a problem that we have to deal with. Mr. Redick presents his words on that.
So thank you, and I apologize. I actually didn't pick that up in your question. The question is a very good one, and to be perfectly honest, I was sort of avoiding it because the answer is nuanced, and the more nuanced, the more room there is for misunderstanding. But once the question is out there, so b'siyata d'shmaya to say the right thing and to be understood. Fundamentally, you're certainly correct. If someone that we know to be a Mechal Shabbos comes into shul, we don't take him by the jacket and throw him up, God forbid. We don't do anything of the sort. We live in a day and age when the way to influence people is, as the Chazon Ish says, ba'avosos ha'ava, with cords of warmth and nurturing, not with harsh words and the like. If the person who doesn't observe Shabbos came into shul with a pin saying, I am a Mechal Shabbos and part of it, if he wanted to come into shul, if he wanted to march in the down Fifth Avenue in the Israel Day Parade under a banner of the Jews, desecrators of Shabbos, so we would tell him that he's not welcome in the shul. And if someone feels that I believe in the Torah, but the flesh is weak, and I'm doing something that I know is wrong, a person doesn't publicize it. I'm not sharing with anyone here all my faults. They're wrong. I'm embarrassed about them. I'm not going to publicize anything. Publicize them. Ashrei nesoi pesha k'soi chata'a. if I'm comfortable gratuitously, not to I'm sharing, oh, I'm a recovering alcoholic, so I'll share my story to help other people in the same situation. But if I gratuitously make it known I live in sin and the name is on the mailbox, we file a joint tax return. So that goes beyond someone who's a mumar l'teyavon, someone who habitually sins, not because he rejects the mitzvah, but because he just habitually gives in to his desires. If it's really compartmentalized, that the person is only a mumar l'teyavon, that it's he accepts the Torah and recognizes that what he is doing is sinful. How is that possible? Because all people are capable of being inconsistent. That's how it's possible. And all of us are, but just to varying degrees. Not to such glaring degrees in most cases. If a person really, really recognizes and acknowledges the behavior as sinful, So then what you said is entirely true and on the mark. But that isn't the case if it's gratuitously publicized. Alachas kama v'kama, it isn't the case if it's celebrated. It isn't the case if the person identifies with the gay movement in broader society. The gay movement in broader society does not consider the behavior sinful. I hope that's understood. I don't know. I'm not a sociologist. I can't tell you how many cases that there are that fit all those criteria. Even the convention to come out and announce it is something which is very hard to reconcile with a belief and an acknowledgement that the Torah says that the behavior is sinful. So what you said in theory is true. And if there are cases that are there, then it's true in practice also.
One thing, if I had someone to my house and we're discussing being single and the challenges of being single, or somebody comes to my house not keeping Shabbos, they haven't talked about the beauty of Shabbos and the challenges of not keeping Shabbos. And in terms of chinuch habanim, when you have an open home, and now all of a sudden, how much do you want to expose your children, specifically kids 14, 15, 16 years old, who are in a Beis Yaakov system or in a yeshiva system, how would you, what are the Rav's thoughts on chinuch when it comes to these issues? Part of the bigger
question of how we relate in general. In my head, a little bit of a, there has to be boundaries in my shabbos space, what discussions are. It's all part of the having such an individual at the table. I didn't mean that therefore this becomes the focal point or even part of the conversation necessarily. I think you're I don't think you need me to tell you this. You're 100% correct that kiruv rechokim or chizat to others isn't done on at the expense of the chinuch of one's children. What that translates to, again, as you very correctly indicated, it depends on how sheltered or how exposed, anyway, the children are, and which is obviously a function of which of the various Torah societies and which of the various educational systems they're in. But clearly, if there's, and I don't mean this in a negative way, I mean in a positive way, if the child is in the bubble of Kedusha that's going to be pierced by this, so then that conversation shouldn't be at the Shabbos table. If the child, for better or worse, isn't in that insular bubble, so then it's a different story, and very much has to be decided on an individual basis.
Could one argue the bubble of Kedusha sort of adds to the problem, or sometimes the problem, but the issue that Orthodox people feel towards other people who are struggling through this? Our bubble is not that we don't speak.
I don't think there's any adult in today's world who lives in a bubble. Doesn't matter where you live. We all have cell phones in our pocket. The only reason I don't know is my cell phone doesn't work anyway, so I got tired of carrying it around. But we all have cell phones in our pocket. No one lives in such a bubble. I don't think there's any adult who lives in such a bubble. A, B, this problem is across the board. This problem is not only in certain segments of society. This problem is mamash across the board.
So I have two fundamental questions in the collateral process. The first is that the pursuit and the use of the language Lotishka Mishavisha, how do we, and this is different language from other sexual prohibitions, which is translation being don't want to cover the nakedness of, but I forget the Hebrew. How do we understand the difference in language as being important? And why not use the same phrase for this case? The other question I have is regarding the sugya of androgynous. And the Gemara seems to look at this pasuk in terms of and asking if this is referring to an androgynous, like somebody who seems to be both male and female, and why that halakhic avenue, considering it that way, is eventually rejected.
So I don't know of a way of really answering the question, being totally refined. What Chazal tell us about the Mishkevei Isha is that we also derive from this verse, which prohibits male homosexual behavior, that, let's say, a man and a woman, adulterous, incestuous relationship, if they would have relations, not the normal way that man and woman have relations, but what's called anal relations, that would also be, that's also included in the prohibition. And what it says, Mishkevei Isha, that the fact that the word Mishkevei is in the plural is telling us that, and it's quite clear why this is the natural context to tell us, that since that's also considered constituting the sexual act, both between in a heterosexual union, so that's also why it's considered a sexual act between in a homosexual context, and that's why this wording is used. The androgynous is the halacha treats, because anatomically the androgynous has both the in terms of the sexual organs, it has both male and female, so an androgynous with another man is also considered Mishkav Zach, would also be considered homosexual.
Yeah, I was just going to briefly say, so getting back to Rabbi Haber's question, there was this Musser, talk that I was in, within the last 3 weeks, and I remember this story, which was basically that there was a non-kosher meat shop where someone was selling meat. And basically, like, I think it was a rabbi and someone else was walking by, and someone was, the other person was sort of criticizing, like, you know, whoever was in the shop, or whatever Jew was in the shop selling non-kosher meat. And the rabbi was like, no, we have to, like, I won't even hear that this is the case. Like, he's probably selling candy to kids. And so he totally, like, used an iron toe approach and kind of, like, overlooking this real issue that, like, okay, this Jewish guy's selling non-kosher meat. And I think the background was maybe this guy went through the Holocaust and, like, had a difficult life and ended up sort of in this position where he was doing something that was, like, obviously violating, like, Torah laws. So I'm wondering, like, why isn't this sort of approach to mussar used in more of, like, a social context in terms of, like, you mentioned, names on mailbox. How can, even if you have names on a mailbox, even if you can see that, so how do you know the two people who are male are having relations together, how they're doing it if they are?
So I just meant that figuratively. I didn't mean that was that was proof positive.
Sure.
But the fact that there were two roommates, that the, God forbid, I wasn't implying that the fact that there were two roommates implies anything. I wasn't saying that at all. I just meant that as a figure of speech. You know, that if two men come or two women come and they tell the rabbi or the secretary of the synagogue, whoever it is, you know, in the shul's membership list, you know, please list us as a couple. That's what I was sort of describing there on the mailbox. I didn't mean, God forbid, that the fact that there are two men who are roommates, that creates any cloud of suspicion. That wasn't at all. And I apologize if that wasn't clear.
Yeah,